Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Peter Bregan. I just want to thank our listeners. We just get wonderful feedback on what this show means to folks and how much they enjoy listening to it and learning about cutting-edge stuff and about really good people, because the people I have on this show are really remarkable human beings. It's a great opportunity for folks to see that there are caring, intelligent, active human beings in our arena, roughly called mental health, psychology, psychiatry, and so on. And my guest today is a remarkable human being. Fred, are you there?
Yes, I am. Peter, can you hear me all right?
Yes, you're loud and clear.
Terrific. I was a little worried about doing this at home, but at the office I'd get too many interruptions.
No, you sound really, really good, Fred.
Terrific.
Let me give a little introduction to Fred, but also to the subject for today, and also a little bit of an aside. I like to give out a little information to folks. There's a new article out in Science Magazine that actually discusses the positive studies on psychotherapy and family therapy for people who are having psychotic episodes. There's a lot of good literature out, and it actually summarizes it. We'll get it up on toxicpsychiatry.org, one of my websites. My wife will get it up, Ginger, in the next few days, probably under the topic of schizophrenia and under the topic of therapy. Not that we hold to the concept of schizophrenia. Before telling you more about Fred, I want to introduce the topic that he's going to start with. He and I have both been enraged about the latest attempts to find a way to drug children. And by the way, my article in Children and Society, International Journal, on where I say that we need to look ahead now to banning. We're not ready right now. We got to look ahead to banning giving psychoactive substances to children, not just alcohol and tobacco and marijuana, but psychiatric drugs as well. And you can find that now on my website under the scientific articles, just out. Well, the subject today is going to be, to begin with, sluggish cognitive tempo. That's a new proposed disorder. One of the advocates describes it as following: the child is prone to daydreaming, difficulty staying awake or alert in boring situations, easily confused, easily bored. Twice now they've used that word bored. God forbid our kids should be bored with us. Spacey or in a fog, lethargic or more tired than others, underactive or less energetic. What a potpourri this is. Slow moving, don't process information as quickly or accurately as others. Now, I think I know what this is about. This is about drugging all the kids who aren't making trouble, because, you see, most of the diagnoses are about kids making trouble. Now they're going to be able to drug the kids who aren't making trouble. They're just bored with us or tired of us or thinking of better things than being in the classroom. And all this is about classroom. This is getting the teachers interested in sending their kids for drugs. And who's behind it? We get the opportunity now because the media is doing more critical stuff about things like this. And the ties are directly to Eli Lilly, who is promoting the drug Strattera, which generic name's atomoxetine, Strattera for ADHD, and now they're going to try to push it for this created diagnosis of theirs. This is very much the way Upjohn created the diagnosis of panic disorder, literally, and then promoted got the FDA to approve Xanax for panic disorder. They literally did it. Now we're getting to watch in advance Eli Lilly, with some of the worst people ever in child psychology supporting it, as they supported the original ADHD diagnosis. Now, Strattera is one of the worst drugs on the market. It's the only stimulant drug for children with a big black box warning. It's promoted itself as the non-stimulant stimulant, but for marketing purposes, if you look in the physician's desk reference, it's listed under stimulants because that's how they market it. It was originally going to be an antidepressant. It utterly failed. So basically they said, well, let's promote it for children. And, of course, you can subdue children with a wide variety of drugs. This is a very stimulating drug. Not a classic amphetamine, but even more stimulating in its adverse effects, causing insomnia and agitation and aggravation and suicidality and violence, even more so probably than the classic stimulants. So that's my introduction to the subject. And now to my guest, who I'm so glad to be in touch with again, Fred Ernst, Ph.D. His last name is spelled E-R-N-S-T, Fred Ernst. I first met Fred when he invited me to a conference at Padre Island in Texas. He lives and works near there. And what a wonderful conference and what a wonderful time it was. Fred was trained as a clinical psychologist at Ohio State. He goes back almost as far as I do. He built programs in the comprehensive mental health centers in the 1970s. I did it from 1968 to 69, working at NIMH as a consultant in NIMH. He's had a busy private practice for many years, but is not doing that now. He's done a lot of positive things, working at the VA, developing a chronic pain treatment program, working in behavioral medicine, actually trying to get some psychology into that arena. And most amazing, for 30 years combined, he taught at medical schools, Wright State and Meharry. I think that's extraordinary that he's been able to negotiate that, and I'm sure he's done it in an honorable way. Since 2005, he's been a tenured professor of psychology at the University Pan American. He's working on some interesting projects right now, but I'll let him bring them up to you. And like many of my guests, I often fail to mention this, Fred is a member of our advisory council. Fred Ernst, welcome to the Peter Bregan Hour.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Peter. It's great to talk to you again. It's been a while.
Yeah, it has been. So do you want to take off on this issue of the sluggish?
SPT, they're already bouncing it around as an acronym, Peter. That's bad news because that's where ADHD ended up, of course. I'll have to be honest with you, Peter. I read the news release about this special issue that had been issued by Journal of Abnormal Child Psychology. And as I read, because it was in the popular press, I thought it was a joke. And the further I read, the more I realized it wasn't a joke at all. They are doing exactly what Joanna Moncrief and you have been arguing for a long time, and that is, while they've saturated the market on adults, the new market for the pharmaceutical companies, the psychopharmaceutical companies, appears to be children. And I think this particular diagnosis is a perfect example of how to expand a diagnosis that's already being made in 1 in 5 boys before they got out of high school and 1 in 10 or 11 children at all. And this is a way to perhaps recharacterize some of them, but I think more dangerously to add to the list of children who are going to be given these dangerous drugs.
I have no doubt about it, and we're getting to see exactly how it happens. We're seeing Eli Lilly supporting research and supporting folks who have notoriously promoted the drugging of children. I'm blocking on his name right now, but that psychologist who's just been key over many, many years now, acting like a child psychiatrist and promoting these drugs. And we're getting to actually just see it happen in front of our eyes.
Yes, you might be talking about Russell Barkley, probably.
Yeah, I was thinking of Barkley, yeah. I remember Barkley writing a book saying that stimulants weren't really addictive orally. And we needn't have to worry about giving stimulants to our children. And, of course, we have good research showing that children treated with these drugs are more prone to cocaine addiction in early adulthood.
Absolutely. And, you know, I like to point out, Peter, too, I mean, the couple of the drugs that fall into that category, as you know, are Schedule II drugs, but they are the drugs that are being sold on the street as speed. And I don't, you know, I don't think we create medicine out of a drug by it being legal and being distributed. They're still distributing what I call speed. They're still distributing a very dangerous drug to very young children.
Now, are you suggesting, Fred, that when a well-meaning pediatrician or psychiatrist or family doctor is the provider of the drug, that it doesn't make the drug somehow better?
Yeah, imagine that. And, you know, I think really tragically, having talked to some of the primary care folks about their reasoning behind prescribing some of these drugs is that somehow they've believed marketing more than science, and that is that somehow these drugs are correcting some sort of a biochemical imbalance or something wrong with the brain that these drugs are actually correcting. And they fail to articulate the language to me or to the parents that of the children that these drugs are prescribed for, that these are amphetamine-like drugs. And there is absolutely nothing in the brain that has been identified that's being corrected by the introduction of these drugs. That conversation doesn't happen to parents. What the parents are told is that they have a brain disorder and that this drug corrects that brain disorder. And that is just, if it isn't a lie, it is certainly misleading, and it is evidence of many doctors being terribly misinformed.
So you don't think that being prone to daydreaming is a disease, huh?
It's a disease affecting the entire population if you put the right stimulus in front of the person. You know, and down here, I'm on the border, Texas and Mexico, and many of the children in our school system are entering the school system where they hear only Spanish at home. And can you imagine, Peter, how a 5 or 6 year old child must feel in those first days of class when they hear a language that they are very unfamiliar with? Would it surprise anyone that they look bored or they become inattentive or maybe even become oppositional? I think those are very normal reactions to a situation like that. But we both know they are now highly likely to be put on one of these drugs at a very early age for all of the wrong reasons.
Well, I want to remind the readers, I mean, these children do have difficulty staying awake or alert in boring situations. You know, it's really so bizarre that they'll actually put it right into the diagnosis. Now, I used to make fun of ADHD because it wasn't in the diagnosis, but it was always in the write-up that went along with it in the DSM, and that was that these children would do fine in interesting, stimulating, and well-controlled situations, but they really had trouble dealing with boring things. I mean,
exactly.
Said this, and they've got boring in here twice. The chutzpah. Lord, and you know what? There's a chance we'll get it in the next DSM. What do you think?
Oh, I think it's inevitable. Absolutely. It's on its way unless we make enough noise. And, you know, I hope I'm not too overly optimistic here, but I believe we're finally seeing a groundswell of the kind of literature that we're seeing in the popular press and in the scientific literature of people saying, as I'm saying right now, enough is enough. Somebody's got to stop this runaway train and ultimately protect the children. I mean, and let's face it, Peter, as you well know better than anyone, there are children who are dying on these drugs. Is this treatment worth the death of a child when they don't even have a mechanism by which some so-called underlying disorder is actually being treated or fixed with this drug? I mean, it's really unconscionable if you think about it.
Yeah, well, these drugs, let me be specific for folks. There's really basically three categories. One is Strattera, which is not an amphetamine. It was actually, they tried to develop it as an antidepressant. It has all the basic kinds of warnings, only worse, that the antidepressants have and the stimulants have all put together. It's a dreadful drug given to you by the most dreadful drug company of all, in my experience, Eli Lilly, who's given us Prozac and Zyprexa and other drugs that have gotten them into serious trouble, actually, with the government, with the attorney generals. And that's the one drug. And then there's the methylphenidate drugs, which are sometimes called amphetamine-like. They really are basically amphetamines. They're classified with the amphetamines, drugs like Focalin and Ritalin and Concerta and a variety of others. And then you have the pure amphetamines, which are not amphetamine-like, but are pure amphetamines, which are the variations of Adderall and Dexedrine. So that's the mm-hmm. classes we're talking about. These are terrible drugs for children. They cause brain damage. They cause a lot of depression. They cause apathy. And we know how they work. Animal studies with the methylphenidate and amphetamine drugs, this big class, they just suppress spontaneity in animal studies. They crush spontaneity mm-hmm. in animal studies. So monkeys don't explore as much. They don't play as much. They don't grin as much. They don't groom as much. And they are very quiet, and they are very obsessive. They will chew on bars or pick at their skin. So basically, we turn our children into good caged animals who are already sluggish. I mean, you've got sluggish cognitive. You make them more sluggish. You make them so that they're just not a problem. They don't throw spitballs. They don't even daydream because their core of spontaneity is cut. And they act obsessively. They copy things off the board in particular.
Exactly.
What more? You got more do you want to talk about in regard to sluggish cognitive tempo?
You know, let me just add one thing to the equation here that I think a lot of people don't completely get their arms around. I mean, this is a drug. This is a class of drugs that is being treated ostensibly to improve the grades of children in school. And, you know, it was just last semester I told a group of 255 students, if any one or more of you will bring me a study to show that, in fact, these drugs increase school performance as measured by grades, I will give you a name in the class and you don't have to show up. I had one student bring a study, and we looked it over, and she said, oh, I get my A because it says right here, statistically significant difference in the grades of these children that were followed. And I said, did you read the rest of this? It's even in the abstract. She didn't even finish the abstract. It also said those statistically significant differences were educationally meaningless. So the point is, it's another one of these situations, Peter, where these companies know how to jack up the number of subjects that they put in the studies, which decreases the variability, or what we call the variance in science, and it exaggerates the amount of differences. And you know, the antidepressants were sold that way, too, with a 1.5 point difference on the Hamilton Depression Scale. This is clinically meaningless, but if it's statistically significant, those are the words that they push out to the public, and the public is completely unaware that it means absolutely nothing. So here we are with a drug doing this kind of harm. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Peter. Go ahead.
Let me add in that that Hamilton, who created the Hamilton Depression Scale, said it didn't have validity that could be used in this manner.
Isn't that amazing?
It's all a farce. It's four or five clinical questions, which the doctor who can tell which drug you're on by your side effects can elicit from you the answers he wants. And you know what? It didn't turn out. in the children's studies, the Hamilton scale didn't turn out to select the children who became suicidal. So it's meaningless.
Yes.
But they live on this. They still use the scale.
They do. Well, I think that the what I call the mental health treatment enterprise is such a runaway train at this point, Peter, that even really people who know how to read and interpret this literature are either missing it or because they're so caught up in the system, they're dismissing it or ignoring it. Because you can't, I mean, these data are so clear that these drugs are doing no good and extensive harm, including death of children, that I can't understand why it is continued at all and why someone would want to be a part of a system that's creating that kind of perpetration of violence, if you will, on the children of our country. And by the way, I think you know the stats. Most of the ADHD medication is being sold right here in the United States. The last statistic I saw was that American children are consuming three times more ADHD medication than the rest of the world combined. Now, what does that tell you about what's going on in this country with its monetary resources that the pharmaceutical companies recognize there's something to tap into?
Yes, you're absolutely right. And, you know, we had this big study where NIMH funded a number of centers with all the old buddies. This was sort of like an old white man's club, mostly of guys like Connors who been supporting ADHD and drugs for generations, really. And they did these studies. I'm forgetting the name right now. But they did them all around the country. And what they ended up with, after, first of all, they got great results that they tell. What they ended up with is that once you get up to like 18 months, about the only thing you could prove with certainty was that it was suppressing height and weight of the children. Mm-hmm. There were no statistical differences in how any of the various treatment groups, including leaving kids basically alone, did.
Yeah.
But clearly their height and their weight had been suppressed. And that's suppressing growth hormone. That's how that works, not just suppressing appetite. So you're actually suppressing the overall growth of the child. What does it mean to put in a child's head drugs that change multiple huge neurotransmitter systems like norepinephrine and acetylcholine and dopamine and serotonin that transform these systems while their brain's growing and their mind is growing? It's just awful.
Yeah. You know, in addition to those, now I'm sure you've seen the new data.
The MTA study. Is how you can Google that study, and you can just search it over the years. It starts out incredibly positive, and then finally Connors ends up saying, you know, I think we need to admit these drugs don't work. I mean, that's amazing, too.
yes, absolutely.
But go ahead.
You know, there's a recent study now, and I'm blocking on the authors, so I apologize to them, but that they followed now some kids who were on the Ritalin and that class of drugs, and are finding increased obesity in those children as they enter adolescence. And I think there is the connection, too, between a lot of these drugs, and especially the ones that are being added. And think about this, Peter, as you well know, if a child is oppositional, in addition to inattentive, it's likely they'll not only get these amphetamine-like drugs, but they will add antipsychotic drugs to them. And we now know, and you know what this does to metabolism. But I think it was at Vanderbilt, they recently reported that children on these drugs show a triple risk of diabetes. Now, I'm living in an area of the country right along the border here where, believe it or not, Peter, the diabetes rate here is 30%. And the obesity rates are extraordinarily high. So we have to ask the question, if these children are being put on drugs that are increasing the likelihood of obesity in adolescence, and then in many cases they have an added regimen of antipsychotic medication – The price that these children are paying is not only the increased weight, but the metabolic disturbances and ultimately diabetes. And as we both know, that's the beginning of a very short life if it is a not well controlled disease. So we have drugs that are being advertised to treat a disease that doesn't exist, and what they're doing is producing a disease that does exist and that does kill people.
A lot of this data, folks, I summarize, as I do most of the larger issues, in the first half of psychiatric drug withdrawal. And one of the things we're finding out, as Fred said, is that these children, and there are now studies following them from the 1970s when they were little kids, and the only thing they had was mild hyperactivity, no other diagnoses, and they end up on multiple drugs. They end up as career mental patients. They end up with increased rates of incarceration in mental hospitals and prisons. They end up with increased rates of drug addiction. They end up with lower accomplishment levels in every area of life. They end up with multiple diagnoses. They end up so fat that they can't be put into the MRI machines as much as the controls. And compared to the controls, and this is so sad, they have brain damage. They have brain damage.
Absolutely.
From these lifelong drugs that they end up on. Now, what do the people claim who do the studies when they say, oh, wow, this is ADHD causing all this? Right. The kids don't even have that diagnosis anymore. Now they've been so injured, they're called bipolar and other diagnoses. So this is the disaster that's going on around us right now with how we are injuring our children. And to this new sluggish cognitive tempo, folks, we really need to fight it, or it's going to be a disaster for our children that grows and grows. Can't overemphasize that for you.
Absolutely. You know, and I think your audience needs to understand, too, that it isn't that there aren't other alternatives. There are excellent studies that reveal behavioral management strategies used in the classroom are more powerful than any medication a child can be given. And, you know, it's also interesting, too, Peter, that even the advocates of these drugs, at least those who are conservative about it, look at the literature and say the attentional feature of the impact of this drug habituates within 3 years max. And if you look at how long these children are on these drugs, you know, obviously many of them are on it from 4 or 5 years old into adulthood. And indeed, to keep them on it in adulthood, we have that the more recent diagnosis of ADD adults. Both of us know the drug companies make money when they can get someone on a drug that must be taken every day for the rest of their life. That's where the money is. And this whole idea fits perfectly with their marketing plan.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're going to go to break in about a minute.
Okay.
We're talking with my friend and colleague, whom I don't get to see enough of, like most of my friends and colleagues. His name's Fred Ernst, E-R-N-S-T. He is a professor of psychology, and he's at the University of Texas Pan American, and we'll go to music and be back in a few minutes. And I think it's great for us to just focus on children today. We can go into Latino children and Mexican children, and we'll have a children's discussion today, Fred. How's that sound?
Sounds great. Count me in.
We'll be back in a couple of minutes, folks. And this is Dr. Peter Breggin. I'm back with my guest, Frank Ernst, PhD. We're talking about kids and this new marvelous diagnosis of sluggish cognitive tempo symptoms. By the way, the only other place I've ever seen sluggish in a diagnosis was In the USSR, they accused dissidents of having sluggish schizophrenia. It was sluggish in that it only surfaced as opposition to the regime. And they gave them, guess what, Haldol and other heavy-duty psychoactive substances for this. Getting back to the children, Rachel Klein, K-L-E-I-N, sometimes it's Gittleman Klein, she's one of the really big researchers behind starting this whole thing of drugging kids in the 70s. Her research was just terrible. When you start looking into it, she had hardly any controlled clinical trials. You look into her research and you find out that the parents didn't see any improvement at all. It was mostly her raters who saw improvement in the children. And they built the whole ADHD out of a lot of Rachel Klein's work. And now Fred mentioned, you know, the new research showing that kids, people at ADHD in their 30s and 40s are more obese. And there out comes Rachel Klein with this garbage, and the NIMH goes along with it. And they never discuss the fact that these poor souls, as Fred mentioned, are now on the drugs like Abilify and Seroquel and Risperdal and Zyprexa, the antipsychotic drugs that cause obesity. And the reason they're on them is because of the career path that they were put on by Rachel Klein and others to be lifelong mental patients and, as Fred pointed out, lifelong consumers of psychiatric drugs, much to the benefit of Rachel Klein's research and even more to the benefit of the drug companies. And these studies don't even mention this fact, including the NIMH write-up, which you can find on the web, not too hard. They don't even mention that 20 and 30 years later, this obesity is not due to ADHD, quote, when they were seven. It's due to the drugs that cause obesity. They're not even on the stimulants anymore. They've graduated because of the damage from the stimulants, these much heavy-duty drugs. I want to talk more and more about this over time, because we are witnessing now the fruits of drugging those kids originally. And Rachel Klein has, she's just mastered the art of harming the children and blaming it on their ADHD. It's time to just get honest about this and talk about this. Fred, am I off base?
No, I think you're exactly right. And, you know, one of the really insidious things about the way these drugs are defended, Peter, as you well know, often they will do studies, or clinically they will withdraw these patients from the drug, and when they manifest sometimes very severe withdrawal behaviors, they argue that that's the disease that the drug was treating, when in fact it's nothing more than the body adjusting to a long period of metabolizing toxic substances, to use a word that you have used very accurately. And, you know, that makes the whole process even, it's almost as if science doesn't matter. It's the language they use to market these drugs. And unfortunately, there are many professionals who are buying this marketing message too and ignoring what's coming from science. As I've always said, marketing trumps science at every corner. It's a much more powerful method of influencing people, to say the least.
Yeah, let me get specific about what Fred's saying. I'll give you an example. The drug Risperdal was approved for treating schizophrenic people and then generalized to psychosis. But actually what they did was they took lifelong disabled mental patients in clinics and hospitals. They withdrew them from all of their drugs, which is a horrific thing to do. It's almost impossible to get off of lifelong antipsychotic drugs. Even with good help, it can be extremely difficult. So then they put them into severe states, and they gave them all placebo to start with. This is called placebo washout. Now, what I'm telling you is scientifically so wrong, but it's done now. The FDA allows them to do it. So then the patients who improved on placebo are dropped from the study. Mm-hmm. So that now you've biased the study away from placebo because you've gotten rid of your placebo responders, and then you start over again. And then what they do is they again give some patients placebo, but they're not placebo responders anymore, and they give some drugs, the other drugs, to the people, and they're all in withdrawal. And, of course, risperidone will, because it's a dopamine blocking drug, act like any other so-called antipsychotic and help the person out of withdrawal by putting them back on the drugs. So they're not actually treating people or having a psychotic break. That's not how they get approved. No, they don't want to try to prove something as hard as that the drug works. They're actually getting their drugs approved on the basis that they stop withdrawal reactions. I hope mm-hmm. that was clear. Is that clear, Fred, the way I'm describing
sure.
that?
I mean, on, all, Peter.
All
That's
this
exactly
is fraud.
Right.
It's all fraud. It's all fraud.
It is.
More about
it
children,
is
Fred. Talk to us about children, your Latino work. I guess it's Mexicans. You're working with Mexican children.
That's right. That's right. Mostly Mexican-Americans who've it's about 90% of the population along the border here are Mexican-Americans. The other 10% are a mixture of Central Americans and South Americans. One of the things that we're doing, and this is just research that we're just starting and we don't have any data at this point, but we used data from the CDC, Center for Disease Control, estimates of how many children at certain age groups are on various types of psychoactive medications. And to make a long story short, we sort of extrapolated from their percentages and realized that in the border area here, there are likely 1,000 children on antipsychotic medications. And given the extraordinary, I mean, there is no area of the country that has higher rates of diabetes and obesity. I think there's an urgency to try to identify these children and to perhaps somehow find a way in which their families are better informed about the dangers that are looming with regard to their long-term health. So we're going to do this through the school system, through the school nurses in the area, because they can identify, they have to know what medications all of the children are when they're in the school system. So this fall, we hope to collaborate with them, and we've gotten some indication that we're going to have access to these data and try to identify where these students are who are already on these dangerous medications and make sure, and maybe even just study without necessarily going in on an individual level, just try to see if we can't find out how it is that they're ending up on these medications already. And then ultimately, and by the way, we've also found already that they appear to be those medicated children for ADHD and oppositional disorder tend to be pocketed in certain areas. And it's not just poverty. My hunch is that it has to do with who the prescribing doctor is in the area. And we're going to kind of examine that as well. That I think, as you know, Peter, there are some doctors who are more conservative than other doctors about starting children on these drugs. So we're going to try to see if we can get our arms around that and then ultimately do something to intervene, if for no other reason, to make sure that these families are well informed about the potential dangers of these drugs, because I don't believe they're being well informed. I don't think they're being comprehensively informed about these dangers.
So you're going to be an activist, ultimately, which is so unusual.
I think so, yes, Peter. It's kind of a late life thing, you know, and I tell my students, if you're not going to listen to me as a professor, listen to me at least as your elder, because what I have seen over the past 40 years go on in the name of mental health treatment, and you know this well too, Peter, I mean, it may have been bad in places in the 1970s, but it's worse now. It's a much more dangerous environment for the American public than it even was then. And I think if we don't do something about it, nothing will be done. And your radio show is a good way to start getting that word out there. And I think it is catching on. I do believe there is a groundswell now of an understanding that something has to be done. As I put it earlier, enough is enough.
Yeah, that is so. We so much feel that way. That's why I've got my new article out from Children in Society, describing the effects first of the drugs used to treat ADHD in children, then describing the bipolar diagnosis and the drugs, namely the antipsychotics used to treat children, and using that to generalize that we just need to say no now, folks. We need to say it is time to end this form of medical child abuse. And I don't think the parents know they're abusing the children, but God knows the psychiatrists, the pediatricians, the family docs should have some idea about it. And it's just time to say no. We're not going to go along with this anymore. There's no excuse for drugging a child. Children need us to change. They need us to be more attentive, us to provide them services, us to love them and discipline them, teach them morality and raise them. Absolutely. Fred, what are these what are the families like in your group you're studying? First of all, are they intact families? Second of all, are they American citizens? Are they legal or illegally in the country?
Oh, no.
What are they like?
Most are American citizens, and most families are intact. And I would say that it certainly has been my experience, and what I have read would confirm this, that nowhere in the country will you find, as you do in Mexican families, extraordinarily powerful family systems. They really take good care of one another in a very family-centered sort of a way. So it is, you know, when I think about all that work going on in Finland with schizophrenia, where they're, you know, they refuse to do a knee-jerk antipsychotic prescription for a first psychotic episode, but rather, if you'll notice, their mental health professionals, including the psychiatrist, have family psychotherapy intensive training, 3 years of it. So their first intervention is with the family. And I'm a believer, and I know you are too, Peter, that the strength of the family can be marshaled on behalf of patients who are dysfunctional or distressed in a far more powerful way than simply sedating or stimulating a patient on one of these drugs.
Yeah, this group, folks, is in Lapland, Finland. It's they're a marvelous group, but the most Finnish psychiatrists don't want anything to do with them, of course. You can find them on the web if you look up Open Dialogue. Open Dialogue. They're an amazing group. They have virtually gotten rid of so-called schizophrenia in Lapland, because to diagnose schizophrenia, you know, the problem's supposed to exist for at least 6 months. And what they find with interventions, the vast majority without drugs, and even when they occasionally use drugs, they usually just use something to help you sleep, you know, a tranquilizer, a sedative. They virtually, these people don't, quote, end up schizophrenic. They don't.
Exactly.
They don't even end up out of the workforce. So
they've
done
all. Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Well, their data are just so impressive. Over 80% are back to work within a year, and you look at the comparable data we have in the United States, it's just flip-flopped. It's the exact opposite. And as you have led the way showing, half of the problem that we have with our persons who are diagnosed with schizophrenia is they are on these toxic drugs for so long a period of time that they have no hope of getting back to work because of the brain injury that these drugs are doing. And that's what they're avoiding in Finland. I think they have a model for the rest of the world, Peter. I really do. And it would work very well here, down here in what we call the Rio Grande Valley, where the family structures are so, so strong and so powerful for change.
I'm with you 100% on that. Fred, what more, anything more you want to talk about in regard to your research, the direction you're going in? Also, people really love to hear about the lives of my guests. It might be good. We have about 10 minutes left for you to spend some time. Just talk about, how did you get to this place you're in now? What kind of support do you have? How do your students respond? How do your colleagues? How does the world respond? You know, talk about yourself and your life.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I'm in late career. I 10 years ago, I came to University of Texas Pan American after 30 years doing various jobs as a clinical psychologist in either medical centers or the VA medical center, and all along having a faculty appointment during those 30 years in one of the two medical schools that I was associated with. I was around when they started up Wright State University School of Medicine back in 1976. I finished my PhD that same year and stayed on their faculty before I went to Meharry. So I was there for 12 years. I went to Meharry in Nashville for 18 years. And you know, I hope that your audience would not misinterpret what an enormous respect I have for the medical profession. I worked with internists, cardiologists, family practitioners who really knew, they know disease, and when you're talking about physical diseases, the mechanisms of those diseases are well understood. And the drugs that are designed to treat them all make sense. And I think that's absent in psychopharmaceuticals. I'm probably oversimplifying, but I think, you know, the tranquilizing and stimulating of behavior is not what I would consider to be a model for treating underlying disease as is done in other branches of medicine. And so the past 10 years then, I have been really kind of preaching on that. On that issue, hoping to stimulate students into getting some passion about these issues, and I think I'm reaching them. I have a research team of undergraduates and graduate students, and a colleague of mine, Dr. Amy Weimer, is a developmental psychologist, a child psychologist, who is also very interested and very concerned about these things as a developmental psychologist. And we're forging ahead, trying to make a difference here. And I think we're just beginning these efforts, but I feel real hopeful. I think the message is being heard. And, you know, in fairness too, Peter, I tell my students, I do a class on abnormal psychology, 255 at a time. And I tell them, look, I'm going to say things that are controversial, even confrontational to my own academic discipline. But I invite anyone to come to this class and anyone that you want to bring to this class to debate this, and we'll have this debate. So far, no one has shown up, and my colleagues know this as well, although many of my colleagues agree and they understand that this is a runaway train that is dangerously out of control. Oh, sorry to sermonize here, but that's where I always end up these days when asked, what are you doing? I like to characterize myself as trying to cause trouble, because if we don't wake up the population as to what's going on, Peter, this can only get worse.
Well, I think you have a wonderful place in the world. One of my fantasies, it's interesting, many, many of my dreams have come true in my lifetime. And many dreams have come true that I never even had before. So being a reformer does bring a lot of marvelous things, and especially if you're blessed and watched over along the way I feel I've been. But one of my fantasies is that some fine university will come to me and say, we just want to make you an honored tenured professor. And you just come on over with Ginger and join our faculty and teach for the rest of your life, as well as all the other things you're doing. I don't think it's going to happen, but listening to you, I think you're in a marvelous situation and you're having a really good influence, and it's a really great thing.
We'll have to bring you in as a visiting professor in some form or fashion. Your audience may not be aware, we're developing a medical school here, and I hope to be able to contribute to it by virtue of the experience I've had as a faculty member in medical schools. Our University of Texas Brownsville and University of Texas Pan American campuses are merging as one university, and we will become, in the fall of 2015, a new university, University of Texas Rio Grande Valley. And in the fall of 2016, we'll be starting up our first medical class of our brand new medical school as well. And I might add, we have an excellent founding dean that has just been hired, who is a psychiatrist. And his background is social psychiatry, and his credentials are outstanding. He's liaison psychiatry, where he spent most of his career working with the interface of psychological issues and physical medicine, and we're all very excited about him joining.
May I ask you his name?
You know what? I just got a block on his name, and he's going to probably see that I get fired for doing that.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Fernandez, and he's from Miami, I believe, or Central Florida, University of Central Florida. He came to us out of Florida.
The one thing not to do with us older folks is to ask us to pop out with a name.
Yeah, it happens to me all the time, and it's most embarrassing when I'm with the person whose name is not popping out. We're very excited about him leading the medical school. And I just look at what he has done in his career, and I have nothing but high hopes for what he will bring to the medical school philosophy that I think is extraordinarily important. And I hope of that. Part of that philosophy is distancing themselves from the big money that can be brought in by virtue of all of these psychopharmaceutical drug trials.
Yeah, it's going to take a giant. It's going to take a George Washington of academia to reject the drug company influence. George Washington rejected being made king. He's the only man in history who ever had an army behind him and a country totally behind him who didn't just take over the government. That's the only time it's ever happened, apparently, in the history of humanity. And and a disgruntled army that wanted him to take over, and because they weren't getting paid by Congress. We're going to need that kind of fella. One of the self-indulgent things I do on my show is to ask, where did my work come into your life? Did it have much influence on you along the way?
Oh, gosh, that's a long story. When I mentioned Rice State University Medical School. When we launched that first class out of Rice State, I was with Barry Blackwell then, and Arnie Allen were on the faculty, and we were looking for material. And Barry Blackwell was one of those guys ahead of his time as well on these medication issues. And he brought in, for the medical students to watch, a video. I want to say it was Madness and Medicine. And
oh my
who
gosh.
Is in the middle of that? That 1978, I believe, Peter. And who's in the middle of that video but Peter Bregan, saying exactly the things he's saying today. And this is why I consider you an absolute pioneer. You have not changed your message all of that time and then some. And that was my first introduction to Peter Bregan. And later, when the Toxic Psychiatry book came out, I read that and have revisited it. And of course, as you know, I think your psychiatric drug withdrawal is a solution. If people understand that you have to get to the other side of depending on these drugs. I think you've written a book that will get people exactly there if they read it carefully and they work with their doctors to get to go about a new way of dealing with life's challenges. So, throughout my career and I have and even in private practice days when it's really hard to dissociate yourself from what's going on around you, and you're almost forced to play the game, if you will. I always questioned, what am I doing? You know, why am I seeing woman after woman in an abusive relationship, who is in an intolerable relationship, and having to diagnose these women with a mental illness for which ultimately some form of medical intervention was necessary, when in fact you and I both know what the cause of their difficulties, their distress, and their dysfunction was. So, no, you've been in my mind throughout my career, Peter, and this is why I always refer to you as a true pioneer, because I know what you've been saying for a long, long time.
Fred, do you thank you for that. Do you think that your new school you're building will provide an opportunity for young psychologists, social workers, counselors to come and train and be trained in a better way? Is that going to happen?
I don't know. Gosh, I would love to say, yeah, I'm optimistic, Peter, but the system is built around, it's just built around business as usual, as you know. And for example, we both know the DSM-5 and all the difficulties, the new diagnostic manual for the audience who isn't aware of that. The new diagnostic manual of mental disorders is fraught with problems. About the only reliable diagnosis in it is a severe dementia. And all of the others have proven to be completely unreliable and invalid diagnoses. So you would think a science-based discipline like psychology would take a stance that we're just not going to use this manual. But I'm telling you right now, yep, that manual will become within the next, the fall introduction of new PhD students will all have DSM-5 in their hands.
Fred, I gotta interrupt at this point. We're just finishing up. Fred,
okay,
Ernst, got it. Interrupting you in the middle, but boy, you're getting your message across in a marvelous manner on this show. I just love your presentation and everything you're doing. Fred, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, Peter. Thanks
bye
for inviting
now.
Me. I enjoyed it. Take care.
And bye to bye. Our wonderful audience. Bye-bye, folks.
Bye-bye.